Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. I'm Mike Thompson sitting in for Ann today. Almost 9 out of 10 Americans have cited love as a very important reason for getting married. This puts it well ahead of other factors such as companionship or having children. The reason for why people get married has changed drastically over time, and that means that what constitutes a successful marriage has changed as well. Joining us today to talk about the current state of marriage and where we've come and where we're going is Eli Finkel. He is a professor of psychology at Northwestern University, and his new book is called The All or Nothing Marriage, How the Best Marriages Work. Professor Eli Finkel, welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher.
Thanks, Mike. I appreciate it.
Let's start with the history of marriage. Not surprisingly, the institution has changed over the centuries, the millennia. If we could start with prehistoric time to the dawn of Western civilization, give us the sort of the Cliff Notes history of marriage during that time.
Well, I mean, the marriage wasn't even a big deal in the, you know, the very ancient past. It was really the advent of farming that made it matter whom you married. And the reason why that was the case it wasn't until we had farming type of economy that anybody actually had any wealth to speak of, right? When they were nomadic and walking around aimlessly, there was really no wealth, and therefore people didn't really care about, you know, how wealth got passed on from one generation to the next. And it was that's really my starting point, because it was when America got founded, agricultural economic structure was what we had. And so people did care a lot about whom you married, and the reason why they cared is for these wealth-related reasons, not for love-related reasons. And in that era, it's hard for us to get our heads back there. Life was fragile in a way that we really don't connect to today. Literally, death was common, and even 200 years ago when Abraham Lincoln was born, he was born into a one-room dirt floor apartment with his older sister. There was another kid that arrived later who died in infancy, and while Abraham was a 9-year-old, his mother died, and then his only remaining sibling died while giving childbirth to a stillborn kid. Like, these are extreme cases, but most of us have a hard time reflecting on how fragile and precarious life was in that era, and therefore what people looked for from their marriages.
The number of women who died in childbirth.
Huge.
It's huge compared to what we have here today.
Exactly.
So you basically focus on the history of marriage in the United States, from the colonial times to modern day. And you said there are three models of marriage. There's the institutional marriage, which is the first model, which you're talking about here, the farming lifestyle.
Yeah. I mean, you know, I find it useful. A lot of your listeners will remember, you know, from Psych 101 or elsewhere, Abraham Maslow's hierarchy of needs that had these physiological and safety needs at the bottom and love and belonging needs in the middle, and then esteem and then self-actualization needs at the top. And to some degree, we can superimpose that hierarchy, Maslow's hierarchy, on the history of marriage. So you're right. There was this institutional or pragmatic era where, you know, this was pre-industrialization, and it's not like he woke up in the morning and kissed his wife goodbye and went to a job. The individual farmhouse was the unit of economic production, and the way that people survived was by working together in order to provide the food, clothing, and shelter, literally avoid freezing, literally have enough to eat. And so in that era, people were workmates. They weren't soulmates. And the idea that you would say, look, you know, Rick, he's a wonderful man, but, you know, I just don't love him, so I'm not going to get married. You would have gotten laughed out of town in that first era.
Was there any love in these marriages back then?
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. People did care that they loved their marriage. They certainly thought it was preferable to love their partner rather than not. It just wasn't what the institution was about. The institution of marriage was about, you know, economic production, the basic survival, and it was also about political alliances. And you know, if you said, Mom, Dad, please don't make me marry this person, the odds were pretty good that your parents were going to say, shut up.
Uh-huh. So even, we hear about it, if you watch Game of Thrones and you've studied, you know, European history, you hear about these arranged marriages to keep kingdoms together and to unite, you know, hierarchies and things like that and monarchies. That went on to a smaller scale in an American marriage back in, you know, pre-industrial days?
Yes, I mean I don't know that you know the Lannisters are the right analog to think about, but yes, the social connections and the basic ability to sustain a household, and by sustain I mean keep freezing at bay and produce enough food. Those were the dominant themes, but then eventually you end up with industrialization, and that changes everything. That changes not only the economy but also the nature of marriage.
Also, Matt, you have to assume that your choice of a life partner was limited in the agrarian age and expanded as you moved into the industrial era.
That's exactly right. That is exactly right. And it didn't only expand because cities got bigger. I think the most consequential, well, actually, there were two really consequential changes that happened in around the industrial era, let's call it 1850 and afterwards, that overhauled how we think about marriage. The first one was industrialization made a number of jobs available in urban centers. And so for the first time ever, you end up with a lot of young people who are geographically and economically independent of their parents. And that means that they have greater freedom to make their marital decisions. And that means for the first time ever, marriage was first and foremost about the emotional fulfillment of the spouses.
And you call this the cooperative model.
I would call it the love-based era of marriage for the first time that really it's about, you know, the institution is supposed to be about how much we love each other. Again, I'm not saying that every marriage was like this. I'm not saying people didn't end up in loveless marriages, but the dominant cultural ideal changed starting around 1850 and beyond to this idea of a love-based marriage. And the economy, the economic advances that came with industrialization also made life less fragile. I mean, things were still rough. Working in the mines was rough, and certainly before there were labor laws, working in the factories, mines, et cetera, they were all really difficult. But the likelihood of having an untimely death declined significantly as the country got wealthier, which meant that the concerns about those lowest Maslowian needs for physiological and safety need fulfillment declined a little bit, just as people were starting to get greater freedom about what they could do with their marriage, freedom of choice, and that's why they really started prioritizing love as the foundation for what this institution should be about.
We're speaking with Eli Finkel. He is a professor of psychology at Northwestern University. His new book is The All or Nothing Marriage, How the Best Marriages Work. His book traces the history of marriage through American culture and also offers some assessments of the current state of marriage, why some marriages work, why other marriages are really terrific these days, and also some tips to strengthen your marriage. We'll get to all of those as All Sides continues. If you have a comment or a question, if you want to share what has made your marriage successful, we urge you to give us a call, 614-292-8513. Or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. In these first two phases of marriage in American culture, where was divorce? Did people get divorced in the phase of marriage that was basically to provide for your spouse on the farm? And then as the Industrial Revolution grew and choices expanded, trace the history of divorce in those two phases.
It was extremely rare. I mean, certainly early on in the what we might call the pragmatic or institutional era, that first era, it was extremely rare that people got divorced, right? Like, what would you say? You'd say, look, I'm not fulfilled, or you know, and people would say, suck it up and stay married. There were legal reasons to marry, abuse, desertion, but these were hard to prove, and so mostly people weren't getting divorced. And then as the emphasis shifts to personal fulfillment, you see a very slow at first, but then more rapid trend toward increasing divorce rates. Going back into the 1800s is when you start to see this slow increase in divorce rates, because, you know, now there is more sympathy for just saying, well, we're incompatible. I mean, the phrase irreconcilable differences as a legally meaningful term goes back, what, 40, 50 years. You used to have cause. And cause meant something like abuse, desertion, something like that. Mm-hmm. And then, this is actually a reasonable spot to transition to the third era of marriage, because this love-based model that really takes off after 1850 reaches its peak in the 1950s. So throughout that century, there's this increasing emphasis on love, and the ideal is that it's a breadwinner, homemaker, love-based view of marriage, and people had strived for that for a while. This was like a fantasy that in the ideal world we'll be able to have this sort of gendered love-based marriage.
This is the Leave It to Beaver, Father Knows Best model.
Exactly.
Even Harriet. Yeah.
Yeah.
How real was that? Was that an accurate portrayal of what American marriage was during the 1950s?
Yeah, I mean, well, look, I mean, TV, I know. Certainly, we weren't getting a representative snapshot of our culture, right? I mean, it wasn't like, you know, there was the black couple and the Asian couple and so forth. But yes, I mean that Ozzie and Harriet model or Leave It to Beaver model worked for the 1950s. The problem is that we have solidified it in our cultural psyche as traditional marriage, and the assumption is, oh, that's how marriage always was, and then we can evaluate how marriage is now by contrast to the way it always was. But that's not at all true. In fact, the historian Stephanie Kuntz has done some of the most important work on this, and she has a book called The Way We Never Were, and it's about how there was this really weird snapshot of time, maybe call it 1947 to 1962 or something. People call it the long decade of the 1950s. And it was during that era true that for example, a high school educated boy, young man, could make a living for a family of four and you know, move out into a small house in the suburbs. And they were able to live on one income. And there was a baby boom. It was like the only time in American history where there was like a surge in birth rates. Usually you're seeing just declines. So, yes, it is true that that's what the 50s really were like to a large extent. But it certainly is true that the 1950s style marriage was the way marriage used to be. It was an extremely bizarre eye blink in historical time.
Eli Finkel, author of the book The All or Nothing Marriage, How the Best Marriages Work, is our guest here on All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. From 1965 on, what's marriage like? How has it changed in this latest phase?
Yeah, I mean, and this is where we see some fascinating stuff that will look very familiar to us today. And in fact, we are still in this third or self-expressive era. So the 1950s settles down, right? So we have this breadwinner homemaker thing, and people had been looking for that for a long time, and they thought, great, we've reached the end of marital history, and we're going to be happy. And the reality, as we know now, is that that wasn't true at all. And so in the 1960s, and just to remind everybody, the pill comes out in 61, 63 is Betty Friedan's The Feminine Mystique, 64 and 65 is the major civil rights legislation, and Vietnam is kicking off. That's the era, and it explodes these restrictive, or what was suddenly perceived to be restrictive, social roles. And what becomes crucial in marriage is not just that we love each other, but that we help to foster each other's personal growth, self-expression. We give each other a sense of vitality and meaning and purpose. And again, think in terms of Maslow's hierarchy. You can talk in terms of self-actualization. Is my partner, is my spouse, bringing out the best version of me, or am I kind of stagnant here? And so it's really in this era, the post-1965 era, the current era, where you could hear somebody say, man, I love the guy, he's a very good father, or I love the woman, she's a very good mother, but I just don't feel like I'm growing, and I'm not going to stay in a marriage where I feel like I'm not growing. And so, yes, there's love here, but I need to look elsewhere.
All right,
and
well,
that's where we are today.
And when we come back, we'll discuss more about what's going on today and the current state of marriage and what makes a successful marriage. We'll try to get to the bottom of that as All Sides with Ann Fisher continues on 89.7 NPR News. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher. I'm Mike Thompson sitting in for Ann today. We are talking about how marriage has changed over time and what the latest research can tell us about how the best marriages work. Still with us is psychology professor at Northwestern University, Eli Finkel. His new book is called The All or Nothing Marriage, How the Best Marriages Work. Eli, you write, the best marriages of today are better than the best marriages of earlier eras, and we are experiencing the best marriages the world has ever known. How do you get to that?
Yeah, I'm actually glad you asked that, because we left before the break on a bit of a downer, which was, you know, now people are willing to divorce over, you know, much less or different sorts of things than in the past. But let's revisit Abraham Maslow. So when he talked about this idea of self-actualization, that is becoming the ideal or most authentic version of yourself, what he observes is that it's really that sort of need fulfillment that can produce a profound sense of richness of the inner life. So he's clear that meeting those lower needs, like for, you know, food and shelter, that's a pretty big deal, because, you know, dying and freezing are not good outcomes.
Yeah.
But he's also clear that if you want to talk about what provides a meaningful, fulfilling life, a profound sense of fulfillment, it's really up there toward the top of his hierarchy. So as we've seen marriage in America ascend, as we've seen the sort of cultural understanding of how marriage should work shift from more, you know, the meeting of physiological and safety needs to the meeting of love and belonging needs, and increasingly now to the fulfillment of esteem and especially self-actualization needs, it puts within reach this type of fulfillment that Maslow talked about, that this you know, profound sense of meaning and richness of the inner life. And so in the 1950s or in the 1800s, people weren't really looking to marriage to help them meet the needs atop that hierarchy, self-actualization needs, for example. But today we are. Most of us want not only love and belonging, but also those higher level psychological needs. And some of our marriages, a healthy minority of our marriages, are actually working to fulfill those needs successfully. And those marriages are fulfilling at a level that would have been out of reach when people weren't even trying to fulfill those sorts of needs through marriage.
Yeah, you're right. The average marriage in America is weaker, but the best marriages are stronger. Because those are the ones you're talking about.
That's what I'm talking about. And that is the thesis of the all or nothing marriage, is that we have entered a new era of marriage today where what we're asking for is fragile and delicate and tricky, right? So you know, it's not like it was simple to grow enough corn back in 1800 or to, like, you know, necessarily stay employed in your job in the 1950s and so forth. But what we're looking for today is about our deepest and most complex psychological needs. So each of us can think about ways in which we're falling short of the ideal or most authentic version of ourselves. And why is it that we haven't achieved those things? Well, because it's really, really hard. And a lot of the reasons why we don't have some of the successes that we would like to have are actually unconscious. And so now we're looking to our marriage to help us meet these much more fragile, idiosyncratic, delicate types of needs. And because of that, more and more marriages are falling short. Those sorts of demands are complex and tricky, and require a great deal of time and attention and communication skills.
Are we asking too much from the institution? I mean, that seems like a lot to ask. It's a heavy lift to meet all of those needs.
You know, that was my initial thesis. I mean, the book I wrote is not the book I initially intended to write. I initially intended to write a book called The Freighted Marriage. And the idea was, man, we're asking a lot, you know, and then actually trace the history and the science of this stuff, and then talk through, well, okay, how many hours are we spending alone with our spouse, and how much investment are we making in the marriage, and saying, look, there's a disconnect here between what we're looking for and what we're actually investing in the marriage, and consequently, we're actually really harming the institution. I changed my thesis. Like, when I actually went into the history and the sociology of this stuff, again, I'm a psychologist, so I didn't know this stuff as well, I came to a different conclusion about how things are going. So your question of, are we asking too much, can't be asked in isolation, right? The question is what I'm asking of my marriage appropriately calibrated to what the marriage can realistically provide?
That's a great, well, what's the answer to that question? I guess what your title of your book is All or Nothing Marriage.
Right.
Is it all or nothing? Or is there, you know, half? Is there a midway point? Is there a balance between all or nothing?
I mean, I think the all label is pretty close to true. Like, I think people who are flourishing, you know, those of us who are able to build successful marriages today really are enjoying a level of connection that was out of reach when, again, we weren't looking to fulfill these sorts of needs. But nothing is an exaggeration. So the idea isn't that you either have like the perfect, it's not binary, right? You either have this terrific marriage or you have this terrible marriage. The idea behind the all or nothing marriage is, relative to earlier eras, the best marriages are indeed better, but the average marriage is getting worse. And so the idea is that the current era is an era of divergence, of bifurcation, where when we would have a marriage that would have been like, hey, it's pretty good, I'm pretty happy with it, in 1950, now we look at it and say, man, it's really falling short of what I expected. I'm pretty disappointed.
We're talking with Eli Finkel. He's a professor of psychology at Northwestern, also the author of the book, The All or Nothing Marriage, How the Best Marriages Work, talking about the history of marriage through American society and how the demands and the expectations we have for this institution have increased, have changed over the years. Let's go to Brian in Upper Arlington. He has a question. Go ahead, Brian.
Thank you for taking my call. I was just curious about religion and how that has played a role. It hasn't come up yet, but for a long time it has played some kind of a role. And as studies show that people are moving away further and further from institutional or organized religion, does that play a role in people becoming more comfortable with divorce or, you know, these other factors? But at some point, it feels like we were almost programmed that religion was in the background, and that's kind of played a big role. And just in general, I thought I was just curious if that played a role, and I'll take any answer off the air there.
Great. Thank you for the question. Great question, Brian. What's been the role of religion over the course of American marriage?
I mean, that really is a great question. And I would say a lot of these changes that I'm talking about have been driven by a decline in the role of religion in the life of the average American. Religion plays a much less centrally organizing role in our lives. That's not just to say that there are more atheists and agnostics than there were in the past, although that is true by a very large margin. It's also to say, even among religious people, the role that the church plays, or the mosque or the synagogue or what have you, is much smaller and more circumscribed than it used to be. And one of the more interesting ideas that emerges from psychology and that I play with in the book is the idea that as religion has declined, the self has ascended. And in particular, Roy Baumeister and his colleagues, he's a professor at Florida State, they have argued that the self has become a value base. And what he means by the term value base is the moment when you no longer need to ask why. Let me give you an example. So you might say, I think it's important to eat kosher food. Well, why is that? And you can keep asking the why question until you eventually get to the point where you say, because God says so. And that is considered a value base. And these days, as religion has declined, the self has become a value base. So you can imagine working through a similar set of questions. And eventually you get to the point where you say, because it's not who I am, because it feels inauthentic when I do that. So hey, wait, why are you going to get divorced? Because to be true to myself, I feel like I need to.
So you can be a devout Catholic, for instance, where divorce is a serious sin, but say, you know what, I'm going to get divorced. I'm still a devout and religious person, but I'm going to get divorced because this is just not working for me.
Well, there's no question that there still is variation today in how religious people are. So a devout Catholic may well may well stay married, and in fact may well not fully subscribe to the current vision of marriage in America. I mean, just because there's sort of reasonably broad agreement about things doesn't mean that every single individual adheres to it to the same amount. So a devout Catholic today might have a perspective on marriage that's closer to the first or the second era. But what I would say is, relative to a Catholic in the 80th percentile of devoutness from 100 years ago, the Catholic of the 80th percentile of devoutness today is likely to have a more self-expressive perspective on marriage, mm-hmm. right, relative to the past.
We're talking with Eli Finkel, author of the book, The All or Nothing Marriage. He's a psychology professor at Northwestern University. We're talking about the state of marriage currently in the United States, what makes a good marriage, and what are the expectations that each partner has in a marriage. Our phone number, 614-292-8513. If you'd like to participate, why is your marriage working? Give us a call, 614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. Let's talk about some of the practical things, Eli. The divorce rate, it's remained fairly steady at around, 45% over the past several decades. What does that tell you that roughly half of marriages end in divorce?
Well, I think there's a few ways of thinking about this. I mean, one thing that we need to think about for context is the 1960s and 70s, this first part of the self-expressive era, positively exploded the institution of marriage. I mean, divorce rates went from about 25% in, say, 1965 to about 50% in 1980. I mean, it is just an absolute surge in the rates of divorce. And then you're absolutely right. Starting around 1980, if anything, the divorce rates have come down a little bit. That's the first thing that we need to appreciate. The second thing we need to appreciate is that these divorce rate statistics are misleading in the sense that they collapse across a lot of interesting differences.
Yeah, you talk about high school education versus college education.
Yes, exactly. I mean, so it turns out that if you look at the divorce rates among people who haven't graduated from high school, they surged in the 1960s and 70s, just like everybody else's did, but they've continued to surge. That is, the divorce rates are just continuing to increase among people without a high school degree. And in fact, the divorce rates are increasing even as the rates of marriage are decreasing. So things are actually looking pretty rough at the lower end of the socioeconomic spectrum. But if you were to take people who have a college degree, for example, the divorce rates have come down very sharply since 1980. And I think what's happening...
The rate's about 16%, right? 16?
Yeah.
College degree.
The statistic you're talking about is if you take people who were married between 1990 and 1994...
Yep.
And then followed them for 10 years to see what percent were divorced, it was 16% of people who had a college degree, who divorced within 10 years.
Okay.
So the rates will be higher than 16% when all is said and done, but of course we can't fully calculate them until that entire generation has passed on.
But why the difference? Is it stability? Is it maturity? Why is there such a sharp difference between those two economic groups, education groups?
Yeah, I play with this in the book. I mean, I was actually a little shocked when I discovered the magnitude of the disparity and how different it is, how big the difference between, say, the highly educated and the less educated today relative to, say, 1975. And there's a number of reasonable hypotheses, but some of them we can rule out right away based on data. So one hypothesis is that people who don't have a high school degree don't value the institution of marriage enough. The evidence is very clear that that's not true. They value the institution every bit as much, if not more, than higher educated people. A second one is maybe they have faulty instincts about what makes for a good marriage, what's important in a marriage, but there's basically no difference across, even people on welfare versus really wealthy people and everyone in the middle. There's really no meaningful difference in terms of how important they think certain things are in a marriage, like, for example, supporting each other's hopes and dreams, loving each other, those sorts of things. So what I think is happening, and we can consider this from the all or nothing marriage perspective we've been talking about already, is these types of expectations that even people without a high school education have, these sort of top of Maslow's hierarchy sorts of expectations, require a great deal of time and attention dedicated to the relationship. And it turns out to be pretty difficult to spend the time together and have that time be high quality time if you're really scrambling.
Yeah, working two or three jobs or...
Yeah, and a lot of it is, it's two or three jobs and it's like commuting for 3 hours on the bus. And so, first of all, they have more stress And we know that stress is a huge predictor of marital quality across the, you know, socioeconomic spectrum. And then second, they don't really have the time, emotional resources, and other sorts of resources that you might want to have if you want to invest in the marriage to help you meet the aspirations that most of us bring to the marriage today.
People are waiting longer to get married now than they have in the past. Does that make a marriage stronger in the long run?
In general, people who marry older do tend to do a little bit better. That is, they're less likely to divorce. They're more likely to have a higher quality, more satisfying marriage. It's hard to unconfound those sorts of effects from all sorts of other variables. For example, people who go to college tend to marry later than people who don't go to college, and we've already talked about socioeconomic differences. But from my perspective, from this all-or-nothing marriage perspective, it makes some sense to spend a healthy amount of your 20s, maybe all of it, for example, and maybe even more, trying to figure out, okay, who am I? What do I value? What's important to me? And yes, dating a number of different people to find out what it is that's particularly compatible with me, what partner qualities work really well with me. Because the truth is, you can't really forecast that stuff, mm-hmm. right? You need to have these sorts of life experiences to get a sense of what sorts of qualities are especially compatible and especially important to you, because they may not be the same qualities that are crucial to your best friend.
We're talking with Eli Finkel. He's a professor of psychology at Northwestern University. His book is The All or Nothing Marriage, How the Best Marriages Work. We'll continue our conversation. We'll look at some tips for a strong marriage, how to make your marriage among the best in American history, when All Sides continues here on 89.7 NPR News. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher. I'm Mike Thompson, sitting in for Ann today here on 89.7 NPR News. We're talking about the state of the American marriage. Our guest is Eli Finkel. He is author of the book, The All or Nothing Marriage. He writes, the best marriages of today are better than the best marriages of earlier eras. He says, we are experiencing the best marriages the world has ever known. But he also writes, these marriages take a fair amount of work. We're going to talk about some tips to strengthen our marriages in just a moment. But first, I want to get to a couple calls real quickly here. Some good points that we haven't talked about yet. And let's go to Pat from Upper Arlington. You're on the air, Pat.
Yes. I wanted to say I went to Northwestern, so I have, but I'm 87 years old, and I had five children as a result of our marriage. To me, I have not heard anybody, either the author or the MC or anybody, mention children. To me, they are the most important part of any marriage. And what we did, my husband and I, was iron things out. We had rough spots in our marriage, but I can't say we stayed together for the sake of the children, because we loved one another. But I think the children their part in the marriage is very, very important.
All right, let's get an answer to that. Go ahead, Eli Finkel. The role of kids in strengthening or weakening a marriage.
Yeah, I mean, I concur. I agree entirely. And in fact, it's wonderful to hear what I think is such a good example of somebody talking about what the upsides are of the 1950s marriage. And what's interesting about that is, yes, if I understood the caller correctly, what she's saying is, look, I married this man. I presume she loved this man, but the point was that she had she wasn't looking for self-expression from the marriage. She was looking for a solid relationship that provided a solid foundation for the children. And so far as I can tell from what you said, she succeeded in providing that. And I have nothing but admiration for that. Mm-hmm. It is interesting to contrast that with what people are looking for today, even when they talk about children. Today there's a lot of emphasis on the development of children in terms of, I mean, this too is a self-expressive endeavor, right? The children themselves are supposed to be sort of in touch with their authentic selves. We are parenting in a way that helps us get in touch with our authentic selves. And lest I sound judgmental, my goal is not really to sound judgmental about the current approach, but it is interesting to contrast it with what I perceive to be a much more straightforward approach that the caller offers that says, look, you get married, you have children, you hope that you love your spouse and you do the best you can and obviously have a good relationship. And part of what makes for a good relationship is that you've raised healthy and happy children. But she wasn't looking for some of these other sorts of things. And again, that is a good illustration of an earlier way of thinking about marriage. And I certainly admire it.
Okay, let's get one more call here. Rick from Columbus, you're on the air.
Yes, how are you?
Good, thanks. What's your question?
Great question is, you know, and I don't think I've heard this, but how much of a role or factor did sex play in the marriage and having a robust sex life with your mate? I'd be curious to know what your findings or research discovered on that, and I'll take your answer off the air.
Thanks, Rick. Appreciate your question.
There are two ways we can come at that. One is from a historical perspective, and for a long time, people assumed that women didn't really have sexual cravings, and you know, it really wasn't until early in the 20th century that people started getting serious about the possibility that women too should find sexual satisfaction through sex. Of course, conjugal sex, because sex outside of marriage was totally disapproved of until really the late part of the 20th century. Increasingly, sex becomes an important part of marriage, and as you look at marriage today. Sex is absolutely essential. The phrase I use in the book is that good sex and a good sex life has largely gone from a perquisite of marriage to a prerequisite of a good marriage. So today,
what's a perquisite?
Say that again.
You said what is that? A perquisite? You meant
a perquisite is like a bonus, a little sort of extra thing you get on the side. So it used to be like, yeah, I'd love to have a loving marriage, and if the sex life were good, that would be nice. And now it's like, well, if the sex life isn't good, then there's no way. I mean, many people I think would say, and look, I'm not judging them, but many people would say, you know, even if the marriage is otherwise very strong, I'm not going to have a sexless marriage for the next 30 years or a sexually unsatisfying marriage for the next 30 years. I need to figure out another approach to that, including, you know, all options are on the table, including divorce. So, and let me just talk a little bit about the science. So the psychologists have done a lot of work on the role of sex and relationships, and it is a big deal. I mean, having a robust and healthy sex life is obviously linked to having a better marriage, but it also really helps to buffer people against arguments if you can have like a good sex as part of the makeup process. And there's some research on this idea of a sexual afterglow, which looks at how long after you've had sex in your marriage do you tend to feel more positively about the relationship, and it looks like it's about 2.5 days.
Okay. We're talking with Eli. 2.5, that's, you know, 2.5 days is pretty good.
That's pretty good, right?
You know?
Yeah.
Eli Finkel is the author of the book, The All or Nothing Marriage, How the Best Marriages Work, professor at Northwestern University. You have a chapter in your book. It's called Love Hacks, easy to implement tools to improve a marriage. So let's start first with why you might need these tools. What's the biggest threat to a marriage? Is it complacency? Is it boredom? Is it unexpected stresses?
Well,
what gets you on the wrong path?
Yeah, I mean, one of the things that makes it tricky is it's a little bit of all of the above. But I will say that the industries surrounding marital wellness often emphasize conflict. So I mean, if you think about what actually gets people to a couples therapist, it's usually things like we've been fighting about something. Sometimes it's, you know, we don't have an adequate sex life. But yes, the lack of growth, the lack of passion is crucial, and we often underappreciate it. And in terms of how we can improve our own marriages, how our marriages can, you know, what we can do, like without professional help, to try to make our marriages stronger, the book talks about three general approaches that are based on this all or nothing idea. The first is we can keep our expectations just as they are and invest a whole lot more in the marriage, and I talk about a bunch of strategies for that. But another option is this idea of a love hack, which is, let's say you're not ready to jettison or get rid of your high expectations for the marriage, but you've got two kids at home, or things at work are stressful, or there's a medical diagnosis, and you just don't have the time and the psychological energy to invest in the marriage. Are there quick and dirty things you can do in order to keep the marriage on a pretty good trajectory until you have the time to make, you know, substantial investments in it?
And you first start with looking at perhaps weaknesses in the marriage, and you talk about one thing you can look to spot is folks who make assumptions about your spouse's or your partner's negative behavior, and the key is not to jump to conclusions. Talk about that a little bit.
Yeah, that's exactly right. I mean, Marcel Proust has this great line that I like that says, you know, mystery is not about traveling to new places. It's about looking with new eyes. And, you know, look, traveling to new places can be good for your marriage, too. But one of the things that we can do to bolster our marriage is look with new eyes, trying to be generous about things. And so the example that you mentioned there is we underappreciate how much freedom we have in assessing why our partner might have done what he or she did. So let's say your partner shows up late, or, you know, doesn't return a phone call, or in some other way is, you know, behaves negatively. We have a good deal of latitude to make explanations. And one of the things that is linked to very bad marital outcomes is making sort of personality level explanations, like, well, this is just the sort of person he is. He's an inconsiderate guy, or, you know, she's an inconsiderate woman. And we can instead say, well, you know, he was probably busy, or it's really something, some external circumstance that did it. And so we have some control over how we go about trying to think about what our partner does, both the nice things and the not nice things. And the book talks specifically about how we can go about changing our thinking in a way that's likely to benefit the relationship.
You also talk about insecurity and mitigating insecurity. And you talk, there's a danger in feeling that you know, your spouse and you were meant to be together. There was some kind of a destiny that brought you together, you know, and that can be a dangerous thing in trying to maintain a healthy marriage.
Yes. So there is a distinction in the psychology, the scientific literature within psychology. I've done some research on this myself, that looks at a distinction between growth beliefs and destiny beliefs about how relationships work. So people who tend to have growth beliefs about relationships tend to think that conflict is something that offers an opportunity to make the relationship stronger, and compatibility can be developed. Whereas people who have more destiny-oriented beliefs about their relationships tend to think compatibility is something you can assess right away, and that conflict is a sign of a deep sense of incompatibility. They don't really tend to put much stock in working on the relationship. It turns out that holding destiny or soulmate sorts of beliefs, it's fine as long as the relationship is going pretty well. The problem is, there is basically no marriage ever that's going to be able to make it until death do us part without some pretty significant roadblocks. And it's when you encounter those roadblocks, it's a decision about how you're going to think about it. Are these roadblocks an indicator that we are fundamentally incompatible? That's the destiny view. Or are these roadblocks an opportunity for us to understand each other a little bit more, work through the problems, and maybe end up with a stronger sort of marriage?
Take the detour around the
road. That's right.
And then you talk about highlighting the strengths of a marriage to reverse the making assumption about negative behavior. Don't necessarily make assumptions about the positive behavior either. You use the example of a surprise gift.
I mean, in general, like, I think a lot of us insufficiently savor. I mean, I would say that I am guilty of this, right? So I have some exciting piece of news in my life, and or maybe I get an article accepted, and you know, the inbox goes ping, and the article, I get the news, and I'm feeling happy, and then the inbox goes ping, and then I'm done, right? Then I'm like dealing with the next thing, and I had a moment where I could have actually savored things, and I didn't. And so the ability to savor things in general is certainly beneficial for us, but the ability to savor things with our partner is particularly exquisite, and we can help our partner do the savoring, right? So there are certain ways that we can support each other, not only when things go badly. Like, we think of social support as how can I help my partner when she's suffering, but what about how can I help my partner when she's having a triumph? And those sorts of little day-to-day triumphs, if we celebrate them well, it's like a glue that helps to cinch us even closer together.
We tend to dwell on the negative more than the positive. I think just in human nature, if something goes wrong, it bugs us for days. If something goes well, then it's gone in a matter of hours.
Yeah.
You talk about affectionate touching. Pretty simple, but
you know what interested me about that study. I mean, so every one of these. I mean, there's a chapter in the book on love hacks, and you're referencing some of those. It, you know, one of the things. Oh, and every one of those is sort of science based, and I talk about the available support. What I think is neat about that study is so this is a study where imagine that you are a research participant. You come to a psychology laboratory, and you're engaging in some sort of task. And before you engage in the task, the experimenter actually pulled your partner aside and said, you know, why don't you just do some sort of affectionate touch, maybe a handhold or something like that, while doing this task? Or it's a control condition and the partner's not given those instructions. So it turns out, perhaps not surprisingly, that that touching your partner, it tends to make the two of you feel closer. What I think is kind of amazing about that study is there's another condition, which is you're still touching, but now you're told, hey, your partner was touching you because I assigned him to do it. And it turns out that knowing that your partner was told to do it, knowing that it wasn't some like authentic, spontaneous expression of affection, doesn't matter.
Huh, that's
right?
Interesting.
Relative to people who weren't touched, they still feel closer being touched, even though they know that the only reason your partner held your hand at that moment, or the main reason why they did, was because they were instructed to by the experimenter. And it still seems to work. This sort of physical contact is meaningful for us.
Yeah, whatever it takes, I guess.
Yeah.
Just a couple of minutes left here with Eli Finkel, author of the book The All or Nothing Marriage, professor of psychology at Northwestern University. You know, getting beyond marriage, can we use these tools in other relationships? Not that we want a whole lot of affectionate touching in the workplace, but can we use some of these tools to help work relationships and friendships?
You know, the particular love hacks that I talk about in the book, the science isn't there yet to apply it into a lot of other sorts of contexts, but I am certainly interested. I mean, you've mentioned that I'm in the Kellogg School of Management. I'm in a management department, 50% in the management department. And so I am extremely interested in applying some of these techniques to the workplace. For example, one of the love hacks I talk about is one that we developed here at Northwestern, where we have people write about conflict in their marriage from the perspective of a neutral third party who cares about the best for everybody. And we're able to improve over the course of a year, we're able to improve the amount of satisfaction and happiness people have in their marriage and the effectiveness with which they manage conflict. And do I think those sorts of procedures could apply in other sorts of contexts, including work contexts? I really do. So we're looking forward to testing that.
Okay. Just about a minute and a half left with Eli Finkel. What's the future of marriage? Do you see it? I mean, where does it go from here?
Well, I think what we've seen, these trends that we've seen are interesting. And you'll recall that the beginning of the all or nothing marriage, the beginning of the self-expressive marriage in the 60s and the 70s, you know, took a sledgehammer to marriage, and it looked like the institution might really fail, that marriage just might disappear. And then it stabilized a little bit from the 80s and up until today. And I think the reason why it has stabilized is that we're starting to figure out, more and more of us are starting to figure out a way that we can have these lofty expectations and succeed with them. And so I'm hopeful that we might be able to generate a really productive, effective, happy, fulfilling type of marriage that can apply not only to people who have, you know, education and money, but as the economy starts to take off and hopefully we'll have increasing wealth among the middle class and the poor, that more and more of us will be able to take advantage of these opportunities.
Thanks very much, Eli Finkel. He's a professor of psychology at Northwestern University. His new book, just out, is called The All or Nothing Marriage, How the Best Marriages Work. It's an interesting read on the history of marriage and how it's changed in the things we face today. Thanks very much for joining us here on All Sides, Eli.
Thank you for having me.
This is All Sides with Ann Fisher. I'm Mike Thompson, sitting in for Ann. She'll be back tomorrow on 89.7 NPR News, your all-day NPR News station.